All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled, episode 144. I'm here with Chud X. What's going on, man?
Oh, not a lot. Just enjoying another sunny day.
Yeah. Deborah should be here soon. Yeah, it's cooled down a little bit. I'm wearing a shirt today. I think I had some sort of heat stroke or something yesterday. Yeah. I was in the kitchen. The house was like 90 degrees inside. And all of a sudden, like my shoulders, like the sides, like where my biceps are, like started getting like really tingly, and my hands went numb and I got super dizzy. And Emily wasn't home, so I like ran to the couch and like sat down. So I didn't know if I was gonna like have it. It's like something. Then like I got super scared because my left arm started hurting worse. So I was like, oh no, am I having a heart attack? And I think it was just, I just hadn't eaten all day. I drank way too much coffee for the temperature and not drank any water. Yeah, it was.
What happened? Your heart started to race?
No, but my breathing got kind of labored. Like it felt like my throat was closing up. So I just like went and sat on the couch and drank water until Emily got home and ended up being okay. But it was
scary.
Could have just been some dehydration affecting you weird, something like that.
It was 90 degrees inside the house. So
The heat seemed to catch up with me yesterday too. I was mentioning before we were recording that it's been smoky around here for the last few days as well.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been thick like it has been in the past, but it's definitely been, the farther into the horizon you look, it starts looking almost brown. And I've been told that's from wildfires in British Columbia across the border. But I looked at like their wildfire tracker and there weren't any nearby at all. I don't know what the heck all of that was, but it wasn't necessarily hotter yesterday than it's been. It was still like 90-95.
Yeah.
But then it was like I couldn't stop sweating the whole day. Maybe I was overhydrated. But it was making it for, you know, like my skin felt sticky all day, and I just felt kind of miserable all day, even though I still had a good day. I got a lot done and, you know, felt good about everything, but it just didn't feel, my body didn't feel good all day.
Yeah. I was talking to Emily the other day. We were driving into town and I was like, you know, they haven't sprung wildfires on us yet. So, and then like later that day I saw on YouTube, they have like, you know, news stories on YouTube, and there's some big giant fire on the Oregon California border.
Mm-hmm. McKinley.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're calling it.
We haven't gotten any smoke for that up here yet.
So, you know, it was weird. So we had it for about 3 days and it wasn't that bad, but it was there. I probably would have questioned if it was smoke if I hadn't heard anything, but the day before that, so 4 days before, now someone was delivering to my work, and it's a person that I don't like. They still to this day wear a mask, and they asked way too many questions about people's vaccination status, like the whole time. It's to the point where I don't make eye contact or talk to this person at all. But I pulled my earbud out to listen because she was telling the other people there, like, to be very careful about going outside because of all the smoke. And, you know, there was no smoke. You couldn't see it. It didn't look brown off in the horizon like it did the next few days. And they were like asking her, what? I haven't noticed. And she said, yeah, it's super toxic smoke. So we're not supposed to breathe it, but you can't even see it. And I was like, what the fuck is this shit? You know, like, I already don't like most of what comes out of this person's mouth, but I didn't even remember to mention it to Lanny when I got home, although I wanted to, but it just didn't come up. And then the next day, it sure enough, it looked smoky out, and it did for the next few days. And I just started thinking, man, what if they tell us there's smoke that you can't see, but it's toxic, and you need to lock yourself inside? Because that was what she was telling him, is to stay inside today.
You got to wear your gas mask.
It's the same. It's the same. It's the same playbook.
It really is. And like I said, this person would come in and like ask each individual, have you been vaccinated yet? Did you know that it's available? This is where you can go to get one.
Jeez, like, what are they delivering?
The mushrooms.
Yeah.
In fact, your boss is a friend of mine. Like I've known him for 10 years. I get compost from him and he's okay. He's masky. He's not great, but he's, you know, he's like an old friend kind of a thing.
Yeah.
He definitely wouldn't push anything on anybody. You know what I mean? But, his employee sure does. And for her to be on there just doing this, like it's dangerous to go outside, you know? And I wanted to go over, she's wearing her mask. I wanted to say, have you ever seen anybody smoke a cigarette with those masks on? You know, yeah. Like, are you, I don't know. I doubt she was wearing the mask because of the smoke. Cause I don't think she ever stopped. She's one of the ones who've stayed true.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. It's I forget who, I think it was Joe Rogan who says it's the Deborah Gill, like this one. It's like, it's the left's MAGA hat.
Oh no.
Oh, it is.
I'm just wearing it like that then. Oh my God.
Were there MAGA masks? Oh, there had to have been.
Oh yeah.
Had sure. to have been.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
I never saw one, but yeah, they definitely were.
Yeah. I mean, it made me really bummed out when conspiracy podcasts were selling masks.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I remember one time I was on someone's merch page. Maybe it was Charlie Robinson. And I was just looking at what he had, and there was a tab for masks. And I was like, really? And I clicked on it and it said, masks are not available, you piece of shit, or something like that. I was like, oh, that's great.
Loser.
Yeah. But yeah, what's going on with you, Deborah?
It rained today.
Yeah, it rained a little bit here just for like a couple minutes.
Yeah, it rained for a few hours. I mean, not heavy. And I went out and walked in it anyway, but it rained for a few hours. I mean, that's really unusual for
that's very rare
around here. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
rare when it's supposed to be raining.
Exactly. But so that was a welcome thing to wake up and see it raining.
Yeah.
It's nice. I bet it smells way different when it rains, when you don't get it very often.
I saw something online about how, you know, sharks can smell this tiny minute amount of blood in a huge thing of water. That humans have a better sense of smell for rain than sharks do for blood in the water. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I read.
If that's true, then I think that's being ignored by most of us, that we can't smell it. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
And well, and when you say for rain, like be able to tell that it's going to rain or that our senses pop off when it does rain. Cause mine sure do, especially uh-huh. if it's been dry for a little while.
Yeah, you smell it on the pavement.
Yeah, maybe? Pavement especially, but
yeah,
I don't necessarily like that smell. I did when I was younger, but when it starts to rain, like the next time it rains here, like I'm going to be out in the woods immediately just to kind of take it in, because all the I feel like it's like all the plants are putting off I don't know, some kind of, I want to say pheromone or something, you know.
I've like heard that's like there's some sort of microorganism that gives off a gas when it rains like that, and that's what you're smelling. You're smelling like something's farts or something like that is the way they put it. But that might have been like some Bill Nye stuff. I don't know. So speaking of false science, Deborah, this whole dinosaur thing is
it's hard to separate all those things.
Yeah, Deborah, this whole dinosaur thing is really messing with your mind.
It is. It is messing with my mind.
Why, what's going on with your thought process?
Why would somebody come up with this false story? I mean, and the answer that I'm expecting to get from you is that's just what their big plan is to keep us.
Well, remember what I told you about the whole peak oil, fossil fuels, you know, overpopulation.
Yeah.
I mean, it all, you just got to follow everything down the line.
And it could be too, like, if you're wondering like how it got started, you know, like there was, I think there's a name for it. I want to call it like the great dinosaur race of like 1850s, like when the first, if you look up like when the first skeletons were found, when the first dinosaur bones were found, there were two people. They're both in the United States, I think. One was in like Wyoming and one was in New Mexico or Nevada, something like that. And they both, and it was only a few years before that, that a pamphlet or a book had come out that mentioned dinosaurs for the first time. And then it was within a decade of that, that these two people started to find dinosaur bones. And most of the dinosaur bones that we're told have been found were found in the next decade by those two people. They were competing for who can, who's going to get a complete dinosaur skeleton first, who's going to discover more and name more species of dinosaurs. It was like, it all blew up really fast. And I could see all of that, not being from necessarily the top down nefarious people who Adam and I think are running everything. But just a couple of shysters who were, you know, fabricating something, trying to make money, trying to become famous, trying to outdo each other. Maybe they were even in cahoots together or something, but it, like that it was a big fraudster show. But that was big enough that it became part of the canon of our history. And then, you know, later fossil fuels and all the stuff we talked about last time. I don't know. Just one of the many ways I can look at it.
Yeah. It was just like out of the blue for me. I had never heard anything about that. And
I thought it was batshit insane and retarded the first time I heard it. The first time I heard it was quite a while ago, and it was being presented by someone who was being, I was at least being told, was a Christian. And that it was part of the young earth that we were talking about last time, the young creationists. I was just like, wow, how stupid are they? Like, don't they realize that like our whole culture is permeated by dinosaur and dinosaur stuff? Like, have I might have even thought something like, did they even see Jurassic Park? But that was like a long time ago. That was before my eyes were open to a lot of things that they are now. So I don't know. It's like a lot of these things where it's like, that's too big. It's too big. They couldn't possibly be lying about that, but I'm open to it. I mean, I'm open-minded enough to believe that, yeah, maybe someday something will convince me the other direction, but I really doubt it at this moment.
It's the size of it. That's what makes it so hard. Like flat earth.
Well, you know that they're lying to us about that.
Yes. I know that they're lying to us about a lot of stuff. I don't know about specifically about flat earth.
You you do.
But you know that there are lies there with
certain... I know that there are lies. Yes.
Something ain't the way they say it is.
Yeah. Something's a little screwy.
Why, like, when you think about it, now that you've heard our crazy ideas about dinosaurs, why do you believe in dinosaurs?
I guess it's, you know, like a habit that you can't, you know, it's not easy to break. I have to, like.
Did they have dinosaurs when you were a little kid?
In museums? Or
like,
did they
teach you about them and stuff?
I believe so. I'm not sure about that, but
I think they did, if I understand.
But like, kids didn't have like dinosaur toys and stuff.
Sure they did.
They did?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I'm not positive, but
because I've never seen any like old like 1950s dinosaur toys.
I think I have. I used to love there was this manufacturer who made plastic horses. They stood about that tall.
Uh-huh.
And I had a ton of them. I loved them. And I'm pretty sure they made other animals, and dinosaurs would be something. I mean, because kids would want them.
Yeah. Sure. Well,
boys would love that.
We'll have to see. Because it was a big deal in the 80s for me. Uh-huh. I was never super into them. But there was kids who were like dinosaur kids, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that blew up even more in the 90s with Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Like Jurassic Park, it just changed the way of particularly young boys. Like, I mean, they all, as much as space was a thing before that, like dinosaurs came in and were right beside that. And it's still a thing to this day. My nearly 2-year-old, half of his like onesies that he wears have dinosaurs on them. And that's just because that's what's available.
What's the other one's
spaceships? Space. It's it because we opt for those instead of the other option is dad is stupid.
Or the ones with like all seeing eyes on them and stuff.
I wish I could find those.
I guarantee they probably have them at Target.
I never went there. You can, I don't know. I haven't looked into it. I never did it for either of my sons, but they make like Fulci movies, like on like zombie films and, you know, films and stuff like that. Italian horror films.
Did you say Fauci movies?
Close.
That would be a zombie movie.
Those names are interchangeable as far as I'm concerned. Lucio Fulci he directed some of the goriest, most horrific horror films of the 70s. And I made a lot of jokes.
Fauci directed the scariest film of real life. 2000s. Yeah. From the early 80s until present day.
Yeah. I definitely made a lot of Lucio Fauci jokes early in the pandemic, but nobody ever got them. So I kind of gave up on them.
Well, I'm going to have to check out this guy, see if he has anything on Netflix or anything, because I like horror.
Oh, he might. His most famous movie is just called Zombie, and it's from 79, I think. It's like one that you can find, like the Criterion Collection, like we'll have Zombie on there. Uh-huh. But they're slower paced than most American movies. They're not all that interesting to a lot of people, but hardcore horror fans love Fulci. My old pickup, I drove it around for 10 years with a sticker on the back that said Fulci lives.
What's his most famous film?
Zombie, 1979.
Okay. I don't know if I've ever seen it, but I definitely know that poster.
So Night of the Living Dead's follow-up by George Romero was called Dawn of the Dead. Mm-hmm. But in Italy, that was released as Zombie. So Fulci saw that and said, this is pussy ass shit. I can make a real zombie movie. I'm going to call it Zombie 2. And that's what it's called in Italy, is Zombie 2, spelled the same. There's no E at the end, Z-O-M-B-I, Zombie 2. But then over here, it got released as just Zombie.
Zombie, spelled with the, Zombie Due. That's what they would say in Italy.
Zombie Due.
Due, yeah. That's interesting. I wonder if our guest is coming. I sent him an invite. What do you think?
I would throw out, since I'm talking Fulci just for one sec, Zombies is most famous, but The Beyond is the one to see.
The like, Beyond.
The Beyond. That's an amazing movie.
Are they subtitled?
They are now. Like when I was young, you could only ever see them dubbed. I didn't realize a lot of these. I loved Italian horror when I was young, but I didn't even know it. I just thought they were low budget.
Uh-huh. And
like that they were all dubbed, but I just thought it was like bad filmmaking that made it look like the sound wasn't syncing up right. Then the DVD times of 2000 to 2010 happened, and they all got really great releases where it was restored back to its original full length versions, because a lot of scenes were cut for the US too. They were even more gory than what I saw.
Mm.
But that, yeah, like I say, they're slower paced. The gore that's in it can be difficult to watch for some people.
Okay.
They'll use like real maggots and put them on stuff, and the scenes that are gory, they're slow and they take a long time. So you don't just get to see like a quick little snippet, like a Wes Craven type movie or something like that. It's you're stuck with it for 2 minutes, like while someone's getting cut or something.
Fun.
Yeah, real fun.
Yeah. So, Chudex, we don't have to worry about this. I know your wife didn't want me to let anybody know, but this won't be released until you're back home. You're going on vacation tomorrow.
Yep, I'm on vacation now. I finished work yesterday, and I don't go back for 5 days.
And you'll be traveling south to Northwest Oregon.
That's right.
To visit the Lucky Seven homestead. And it's going to be lots of fun. I'm going to make some chicken wings.
Yep. This is going to be... Whenever I freeze, I still hear you guys all the way
through. Yeah, I know. That's why I try to keep going from now on. I'm just going to keep going and try to fill the space. And then I know you'll be back. So,
But yeah, we're heading down to your place. I'm looking really forward to it. We're going to make some sausage.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. We're making sausage. Yeah, there's 27 pounds of pork in the fridge right now, thawing out.
Sweet. I just put that stuff in the car, packing that first, all the equipment, the grinder and the stuffer and all of that, because that way we can spatially recognize like what space we have to work with beyond that. So that stuff's in there now. It's ready to go. Yeah. And you got casings? That's what I heard.
I got lots of casings.
Yeah, I do too, but I'd rather not take a perishable that all the way down, all that.
Yeah. So, I'm excited. Lanny said it'll make probably somewhere north of 100 brats.
Yeah, sounds good. Close to 30 pounds, under 30 pounds. Yeah, it'll be good. I also packed a couple knives. Real good, real sharp. One long scimitar for cutting stuff up, and then another like a boning knife. I don't know if we're going to be deboning or not.
No, everything I've got is like in chunks. And it's in like a big flat square, frozen square that's vacuum sealed. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, that's going to be awesome. I love making sausage in general. I love introducing people who haven't done it, who are interested in it, to the process. So yeah, this is great.
Yeah, it's probably going to open a whole rabbit hole for me.
Yeah,
and I'm going to have to convince my wife to let me get sausage making stuff. And
you can get cheaper stuff than I have. This is now, you know, hopefully my final setup that I've got, because it's all like commercial grade. But you know, you can get stuff at Cabela's. You know, you can get stuff at your local sporting goods place that specializes in hunting. They usually have like small stuffers, and
yeah,
they look a million different ways. You know, mine looks like the one. Mine is the same brand as the one that's used in So I Married an Axe Murderer. We talked about last time.
Did you rewatch it?
I didn't rewatch it, but I didn't mention when we were talking about the thing I remember more than anything was that she was using an F. Dick stuffer when she was making sausage in that.
Yeah, during the montage, he goes into the meat market. It's like Meats of the World or something like that.
Yeah.
To buy his dad a haggis.
That's how they meet. Is that right?
He goes in there, he sees her, and then he goes back because he thinks she's beautiful. And so he goes back and she's super busy. So he grabs an apron and helps her, and he gets up to a lot of crazy antics, you know, Mike Myers. Mm-hmm. So, and it's playing that one song. I can't really sing it very well, but I know what song it's playing and stuff during the...
Is it that I Have Walked 500 miles?
If I do it all the same, do back for the change of atmosphere situation nowhere.
Okay.
Let's watch it when you're here.
That sounds great.
We'll rent it.
Sounds great.
Yeah, that'll be fun. I think your kid could probably watch that one, right?
I would think so.
Yeah. I mean, he watched Blood Rage. So,
yeah, he watched Blood Rage. he's seen The Thing.
Yeah,
although that was
messed him up
a little much.
That's
a little much.
Scary. That's a scary one. Was it the original or
the original? The original for all intents and purposes. There was an old 50s one that that one's based on, but yeah.
And then there's a new one, right? They did it. They redid it.
Yeah, they remade it.
Yeah, with Kurt, what's his name?
No, they remade it. They redid it since then, Deborah. They like a new one.
New.
Like recently?
Well, probably within the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
I had surgery a few years back and I watched that when I was recovering and I was into it. It was as I was starting to get into Antarctica stuff. So it was like, oh yeah, yeah, this is cool. You know?
Yeah. Maybe I'll go watch that one again. The new one. I like the thing. I never watched it as a kid, but I know that it probably would have messed me up if I did watch it.
More recently than that, he started seeing ads. There was new Stranger Things. I'm sure you guys saw that there was new stuff at least. And he was real curious about Stranger Things. There's like toys in the kids sections at stores for Stranger Things.
Yeah.
And he was like, I want to see this. I got to see this. I got to see this. So we started watching it. We didn't go too far because it was
from the first season,
I watched the whole first season. That's all I've seen of it. And I was like, oh yeah, if you're into this, like I probably wouldn't mind, you know, watching all of it, but we didn't make it too far. He still brings it up. Like I want to watch it more, but he was totally having a hard time late at night, waking up in the dark in the middle of the night and wanting someone to come be with him.
Yeah.
So, and that's the hard part from my perspective is just like having to go upstairs, sleep in a small bed shared with a person, you know?
Yeah. And then you got to wake up at like 4 a.m.
Yeah. Then I'm up at 4 going, did I even sleep last night?
Yeah. Yeah. I gotcha. Yeah. Emily used to come into your bedroom a lot, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And then she'd like spin around in a circle.
Oh yeah. She was like a clock. Her head would stay in one place and her feet would go all around. And then I started putting her little mermaid, you know, cheap polyester sleeping bag directly on the wood floor, thinking, okay, well, she's not going to be happy. She's not going to be comfortable. Didn't matter. She came and slept on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah, she falls asleep in strange places a lot.
Yes, she does. Not an issue for her. But then I bribed her. I said, if you sleep in your bed for a month and stop coming in here, I'll get you a cat.
Oh, yeah.
And we got a cat.
That's how she got Marty?
Manu. Oh, wait, no, not Manu. Or was it? Yeah, it was Manu.
Got it.
Manu.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to go into my parents' room sometimes. I don't think too much, though. I used to have this reoccurring, really terrifying nightmare. And it was, it lasted all the way into like my late teens, I'd have it. And it wasn't like a real dream. It was just complete absence of everything, just like a pit of nothingness. And that's where I was. I was fully conscious in a pit of nothing. And it was terrifying.
Maybe it was like a night terror, you know, or like a lucid dream kind of thing.
I can still remember all the aspects of it. It's crazy.
That's so weird. Because
it was like all the times I had it and for how long. Wonder what it was all about.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's strange dreams now too. You don't have dreams?
Well, that's sometimes
it's good because you get so stoned before you go to bed. Because you're eating edibles and taking Xanax.
I'm not taking Ambien.
You're taking Ambien.
I am not. Yeah, I am not.
You used to.
I bet you still
have a couple left over probably.
Well, if I did, they'd be gone. But I used to.
I'm quite the opposite of what I hear a lot of people say. My dreams go crazy when I smoke weed. Like if I get stoned and, you know, I don't know, if I fall asleep stoned, I'm going to be dreaming wild dreams.
Probably because you're not a chronic.
That's what I was going to say.
You're not a cannabis abuser like Deborah.
Because that's what I hear from a lot of people. They say, man, I didn't start dreaming until I quit smoking weed.
Yeah, and that's what Joe Rogan would always say that when they do that like sober October thing.
And then his dreams would like come back.
His dreams would come back.
I still have dreams when I'm not doing it, but I'm like guaranteed if I've done it that I'm going to have really weird dreams that I'll think about for the day and be like, whoa, I see all this crazy stuff from my subconscious like pulling up through it. There, it's actually pretty fun to analyze.
Yeah, I like those dream analyzing books.
Yeah, they have like the dream dictionary and stuff.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, dreams are how I ended up back in Oregon.
That's right.
I was having reoccurring dreams about this supermarket that I used to go to with my mom when I was little. And I was just like, oh, that's strange. Strohecker's Market. And so I looked up flights to Portland, booked a trip here by myself for a weekend and just drove around and looked at all the old places from when I was little. And then I was living here a month and a half later.
Mm-hmm. Hey, technical question over here. Jared was trying to get at me about coming on. He was looking for a link. I just forwarded him the one I got. Should that be
I've sent sufficient? It to him twice, I think, to the right.
I'm guessing that he isn't seeing that for one reason or another.
Tell him to check his spam, but it should be in there. Let me I had his email on file. Let's pause. We'll get it straightened out. We'll be right back, guys. All right, guys, we are back with our guest after some strange issues we had with our invite links. Jared Murphy, you are here for your third trip on the Deborah Gets Red-Pilled podcast. Thanks for joining us again. We're really happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. Deborah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm so good.
We're going to have to get jackets like Saturday Night Live does when they have a five-time host. They give that person a jacket. We're gonna have to, get a visor or something.
A red pill visor.
Yeah.
I will send you that address. I'll wear that for the next one or three shows down.
Yeah.
If we survive not being connected, this is it. Let's do it. Wait, do you all have to wear them also, or is it just me as a guest?
Just you.
Oh man. All right.
We need to single you out. Yeah.
So Chudex scheduled this with you. I'm really excited to hear it because I love archaeology and old history stuff. So yeah. Why don't you guys take it away?
Yeah, so I was hoping that we could get a good rundown of the G.E. Kincaid story for Deborah.
Yes.
Because I'm assuming, I didn't actually ask you, Deborah, are you familiar with G.E. Kincaid?
Only that I recognize the name, but I don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, I think Jared does an excellent job of telling his story. So why don't we start there? But I'd also like to talk as well about your experiences in the Grand Canyon as well.
Sure, because it was something that I had been was on the list of, okay, things I'm going to go visit and actually look for. You know, I am a climber and there is an amount of equipment that if you didn't climb, I mean, it's thousands of dollars. So it's like, if you're going to go looking for something like this, you really have to have some training. And so it was on the list of things to go look for, but I had been planning an expedition to South America and other field work. And I think I hit my limit. So this is last summer and I hit my limit of people going, well, there's a G.E. Kincaid cave. And I have had a few associates and friends that had gone to it. There was some film footage where they get to the edge of it and they're like, well, it's down there. We don't know. And then I'm like, are you kidding me? It's like of the lowest hanging fruit of urban mythology or possible truths. It's just over the side. Granted, for everyone listening and Deborah, over the side at this point is on the Navajo Nation. It is at a point very specifically defined in a very turn of the century newspaper article. There's two. And their only description we have is that this man named G.E. Kincaid found a cave as he was going down the river in a canoe and doing work as a subcontractor, mind you, not really for the Smithsonian. That's one of the things that gets lost in translation, but he allegedly sees something. So at this point in the canyon, when we say over the side, he, from the Colorado River, having gone over the Quagunt Rapids, very specifically, a very specific mile marker within the canyon on the river, he looks up and allegedly sees a cave. Now, this cave, from his positioning, is about 2,500 feet in the air. Now, from where we're standing above, that's over 1,000 feet below us. So that's a multi-rope down climb. A lot of safety procedures and stuff like that you'd have to do to get down to it. But
it's a sheer cliff. There's no like walking trail up to it or anything down to the river.
No walking trail. There is a section that's very precarious that, you know, I did go to the site. We can get to the part where Rex from Leak Project and I, we've done some things together. And this is one of those cases where it's like, look, we want to go actually find the Kincaid Cave. I have a team of climbers. It's not a singular one or two person job. And also, if you're going to climb something like this or down climb something like this, you need to have a lot of gear. That it's hundreds and hundreds of pounds of stuff. It's thousands of, it's $10,000-$20,000 worth of gear. And you got to be able to plan. You don't just show up and down climb. Well, you could, but that's silly. So the whole point was to go and kind of get an initial look as to where is the cave and let's see what's there. And so to go over the side, there's a section that's very bouldery. And, you know, it's a little, you know, it's a kind of avalanche slide area, but then it drops off. And that first drop off where we were standing, which we have photos of, was probably, you know, almost sheer rock wall. Well, by sheer, it's like, you know, there's rough points where you could grab it with your fingers as from a climbing standpoint, but I would argue it's probably 1,000 feet before you might hit a ledge. And by ledge, I mean one little like 3 or 4 foot footing. And then it essentially on that side drops down to some, you know, geological slough off from erosion. And that pile starts at about, I don't know, 2,800 feet down. And then for 700 feet, it's kind of a very rough death roll. If you were to even say you were going to roll versus just keep kind of perpetually falling, but more of like a cotton ball of a human being at that point. So essentially, quite graphically, yeah, it's about 3,500 plus feet, 32 to 3,500, depending on where we were standing, basically straight down to the Colorado River. And the canyon, a lot of people don't know, it's up to almost 6,000 feet deep. But a lot of people don't know when they're looking at, they lose the positioning across canyon. And there are many places in the canyon that are over 25 miles. So, right. And to give everyone else a weird idea about the canyon, there is the guy who runs expeditions and basically archaeological, anthropological work in Carlsbad, which the same professor was doing hands-on work starting in the 1960, 61, 62 range. They started looking at the caves that are, you know, anywhere from 100, 500, 1,000, 2,000 feet up. So of the 270 miles of the Grand Canyon, they've only explored about 150, 140 miles. So think width, think length, and all those side canyons in the Grand Canyon, just to get water and equipment and people down and to find those locations. Permitting is more difficult than ever. There is literally, basically, though, what I'm saying for all of those out there wondering if there are any adventures left in America or adventures left in the world, there's 120 miles of the Grand Canyon by up to 25 or 28 miles wide that is unexplored in modern times. And to give you an idea, one last point on that, there is a single cave that they explored that single cave has 40 miles of tunnels.
At least.
Right? And that's the minimum. They haven't even said they fully explored it. And then on top of it, again, it doesn't account for quantity. It doesn't account for biological, anthropological, you know, just natural history of animals that have gone into these moist, damp environments and basically been mummified, perfectly preserved for some of them tens of thousands of years. And then there is some mystery around the, what's called the stick people, which are basically an unknown either tribe or culture that the biocarbon dating on these little stick figures that they leave in these caves. And some of them are hundreds of feet off the ground. And they're throughout the canyon that's been explored. The reason they call them the stick people, none of the local indigenous tribes that are alive today know who they were. There's no stories about them. There's no oral traditions about them. But they carbon dated these stick people to over 3,000 to 4,000 years. So this is a group of people that is unknown to all humanity. But that's just one layer, because the Grand Canyon obviously has millions of years of history. But this Kincaid Cave is special, just because it's supposed to be, this man locates it. He scrambles using, let's just assume, ropes and stakes, which I guess is, as a climber, it would be in a way kind of safe, but the tremendous effort to pull yourself up ropes to get up 2,500 feet to enter a cave, which according to him was like the opening of a small 3-4 story building, very wide, very kind of grand, semi-natural looking, but he said there was a staircase as you got close to it, that it was cut into the rock. And when he entered the cave, the newspaper, you know, again, this is a very romantic period, Art Nouveau, you know, Art Deco-y, it's early 1900s, you know, we're just around World War I. There's a lot of discoveries. Think Machu Picchu and Colonel Percy Fawcett looking up for the lost city of Z. There's all these people disappearing or finding interesting things. So this is a man maybe trying to make a name for himself, or maybe it was an April Fool's joke, but because it was published around the first, which was whatever, off date. But the bottom line is that he said there were about 80, 90 mummies. There was a Buddhist-like statue. So the nature of the interior of the cave was more Asiatic than Egyptian. Sometimes it's said to be Egyptian, yet there's monuments within the Grand Canyon, because Egypt was very popular. So there's lots of different things pointed out about the Grand Canyon that are allegedly Egyptian. And yeah, there is a lot of historical evidence for all those people coming to America, whether it's the Celts, Romans, Phoenicians. There is Viking evidence all over the place. Lots of blonde-haired, blue-eyed indigenous people that were reported even early on by early explorers. But as far as the cave goes, that's it. That's what we know.
What's the biggest city in Arizona called?
Oh, I suppose Phoenix.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Here's a side note about the cave as we get into it. Something I did not know, that currently, well, last time I checked, which is a few months ago now, there were over 500 open uranium mining permits within the Grand Canyon itself.
Whoa.
Now, I like being a nuclear power. And obviously, the American government has had various levels of success in cleaning and having EPA-related disasters. So isn't it interesting that not only are there open mining permits for uranium, but of those, there were some settlements with indigenous nations to the tune of almost $1 billion, which has never been paid. And unfortunately, there is uranium contamination. There are tailing piles literally on and near the Colorado River. What I found most interesting about this is, why does the canyon remain half unexplored? Why are there so many open uranium mining permits and nothing's been followed up with the indigenous nations that have not received their money for it? We're talking lung cancer. We're talking various pollutions. There's a number of issues with it. Also, you're familiar with Antelope Canyon, the very wavy, curvy natural canyon that's in Arizona in Page. Sure. I don't know if, yeah. Peter Lick, the famous photographer, has that dust in the wind that's called Ghost in the Wind or whatever. It's a very most expensive photographs ever sold in history. Well, the lake up in Page, that's right up where Horseshoe Bend is. So this is a few miles away. So for everyone who's going to listen and go look at a map, the G.E. Kincaid Cave is at a mile marker on the Colorado River, where if you are in the Colorado River, you are on a licensed, permitted expedition. At that point in the river, you've been on the river for 5 to 7 days at a minimum. You could have been on the river up to 11 days. So the point we drove through very rough land, that we were in an all-terrain Jeep with, you know, unlocking differential, like named the ability to go all terrain. This Jeep had it with a winch. I mean, this was not an area you would, it took an hour and a half to get to the edge of the canyon. And it's not, it is not something you just go out in a vehicle of any kind. You have to have real off-roading equipment. We had a good friend of Rex's who is a Navajo, and we went out to where we would be directly above this point in what's described in the only two articles about the G.E. Kincaid Cave, where this cave is supposed to be. Further north in Page, which is about an hour away from an hour and a half, where Horseshoe Bend is famously, and you can get on kayaks for $140 and take a kayak around the bend, and then they motorboat down and pick you up for all those who are interested. But what's very interesting is the lake that's in Page that supplies a lot of the water for Arizona and for people to drink. Well, it's dammed up, and you're like, okay, well, they did it for hydroelectrics. They did it for, you know, just obviously having drinking water. What a lot of people don't know is that the bottom of the lake in Page is filled with 36. This is the registered amount, because, you know, the government's always honest. And of course, I'm sure they have an accurate count, but there are over 36,000 tons of uranium mining tailings. And wow. Yeah, so if you're looking, I'm going to look, I don't know why I'm missing how, I just don't remember how big Lake Powell is. So we're talking about Lake Powell. It's 254 square miles, wow. But they officially said there are 36,000 plus tons of uranium mining tailings. And they're like, what's a safe way to store uranium? Put it
what's,
on.
What's a tailing? What's a...
Yeah, cool. Good, great question. When you mine anything, whatever mineral you're trying to mine, anything other than that mineral is unnecessary. So when you see like a road being deconstructed and they crush up the first, they, you know, they jackhammer up the concrete or the tar, and then they put it through crushing, they crush it down to more manageable, and then they crush it down to more like gravel sand. And then what happens is a mining company has processes to pull out whatever mineral they're looking for. And in this case, they're only looking for uranium. However, when you're looking for uranium, everything you're around is also radioactive. So that means that whatever your crushed gravel pile is, it still contains unretrievable based on 1950s, 60s technologies. It doesn't have, you know, they don't have a capacity to extract 100%. No, I live in Minnesota. It's a huge mining area, and the U of University of Minnesota, there's a lot of interesting mining research that's been done, particularly in the last 40 years, where they've now gone back to, mining tailing piles, which are mountains in size. And they have, which is why actually we can talk a little bit about ancient history and about the chances that many of these things that we think are mountains may be ancient mining pilings. Tailing piles.
I'm open to that.
That's what our friend Casey from Golden Gate Starfort Command thinks as well.
Yeah, it's crazy. So there's ways to retrieve more valuable minerals. Like you could have a whole tailing pile that was for one particular ore, and then they discover a way like, hey, we can extract every ore we want out of every single grain if we just put it back through a machine. So as they figure that out, they have found that there's value in exploring old tailing piles. But in the case of uranium, that's a problem, because uranium is, you know, uranium. So they, in their great 1950s wisdom and solution, said, you know what, why don't we put it under a lake, and everybody will boat on it. We'll also let people drink out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. These tailings, Deborah, they have horrific, catastrophic environmental repercussions. I've seen documentaries about towns out in like Kansas or somewhere in the Midwest where they just have these like giant lead piles of like lead tailings, and like kids in the town played in them and like would run up and roll down them for years and years. And these towns just had huge amounts of death from cancer. All the kids had like learning disabilities and autoimmune disorders and like hyperactivity and like, yeah, mm-hmm. it's crazy.
It's wild super stuff. It is, because it's floating up and down. How it relates to me for ancient history is that, are we the first people to ever mine it? You know, why did the Grand Canyon end up as big as it is? Just because, it was a natural erosion for hundreds of millions, or, there was that deluge, you know, it was all like massive flooding from, Younger Dryas, or it was millions of years and it was, fill in the blank, maybe Mount Toba going off, and, you know, we end up with, you know, initial melting and refreezing of glacial activity. I mean, there's a million different ways we can look at it, but at the same time, there's a lot of interesting recent history. And by recent, I mean, even the last 40, 50, 60,000 years in some of these caves that they find that have preserved. There's a sloth, for instance. It's a particular kind of sloth that was only in America, and they thought it died 60, 70+ thousand years ago. And they found a cave in the Grand Canyon, this anthropological group. And they figured more than 36 or 40,000 years. They were off by like 40, they were off by like 30 or 40,000 years about its extinction point. And that's a lot of different things. Like even post Younger Dryas, we were home to the camel. A lot of people don't know the camels from North America, at least from what genetically we know. So the camels that we think belong to Africa are actually North American. So not all of them, for everyone nitpicking, just there are new breeds of things, but the camels from North America. And right.
You know, I wonder if camels could survive on my property. Maybe I could start a camel farm.
Why not? People have alpaca and llama. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Why not? Why can't you go back? Take it back.
Yeah.
Take back the camel.
Yeah. And then the short-faced bear, I'm good with that being extinct.
Oh yeah. That thing's scary.
Oh yeah. My gosh. And you know, there's a few other things. There was a leopard. There's a few other things that just, you know, all mysteriously disappeared around the Younger Dryas, along with the in quotes Clovis people. But these caves, you know, they're hundreds of feet off the ground. Why do they have stick figures in them? How were these caves being utilized? I mean, there's really a lot with the Anasazi, the different tribes, Tuba. So where we were staying, by the way, to go to the GE Kincaid cave was Tuba, which is a city right in the middle of Navajo Nation. They had three lovely hotels.
Yeah. I'm sure it's a nice place.
It's like 6 blocks by 6 blocks, but they still managed to have a McDonald's, a Taco Bell, Denny's, three really nice hotels. Ooh. And most importantly, for those of you who are World War II fans, they of course have the Windtalker Museum, which was closed due to COVID. So I did not get to see that. I'm a huge World War II nut. So I did not get to go to Ituba Windtalker Museum from World War II. That really bummed me out. But here's
it's COVID. So they closed the museum, but they keep all the poison restaurants open.
Yeah, because, you know, well, you know, let's, yes. Although they have really a great espresso bar in one of the Navajo Nation hotels. It's a really cute cafe. It's really nice. Great coffee. But what's most fascinating to me, besides the Anasazi and all the, you can go down the alien road with the history, but it, you know, we're within an hour and a half of the edge of the canyon where we're going, but Tuba has acres and acres and acres, and it was too hot. We only walked around about an acre and a half, 2 acres. There is an open parking lot. What you don't realize, you are parking right on diorite and other fossils. But this is what was once a Jurassic bog / swamp. There are landing points, and I got to see landing feet that looked like something had landed and hopped. And they're like, do you see those footprints? That's a pterodactyl. And this entire field, it's actually, I think at least more than a square mile. And it's nothing but every kind of dinosaur footprint traversed this field, and then it dried hard, and there are little stands and you just pull in. It's free. There's a Navajo artist doing jewelry. There's, you just get it, your guide. And depending on your interest level, I would, if you knew nothing about G. Kincaid, nothing about Native American history, nothing about World War II, go to Tuba and stay and just go to the dinosaur tracks. It literally says dinosaur tracks. You just get out and you are walking on them, in them. And there is even a suspected human footprint amongst them. And when I mean tracks, I don't mean you have to wander around and walk. Imagine you just left a semi-hard clay layer of what was about to be imprinted for life. But every animal that you know of has, the footprints are on top of each other. The biggest animal, the footprint is the size of, I don't know, an area rug. I mean, they're on top of each other. They're, you have to sit there and look at them, not discerning what they are. You can see all the footprints. They are every square inch for a square mile of nothing but different kinds of, like the dinosaur footprint with the big fin head that everybody saw in Jurassic Park that spit on the guy. For those of you who have not actually seen Jurassic Park, that dinosaur has tracks there. Everything you can imagine is one of the funnest, coolest things ever. If you remotely like dinosaurs, and there is so much dino poop, diorite everywhere. It's crazy. It's coolest thing that just that.
Okay. I'm flipping right here. Cause I was told a few days ago that dinosaurs didn't exist.
Okay. Is that person back in the hospital or are they okay?
They're okay. They're okay.
Oh, good.
They're
good for doing all right.
Everyone, you can feel however you want. The sky is blue. I mean, or to quote Phil Collins, you can tell me it's black when I know that it's white. I don't know. I'm re-listening to Phil Collins lately. That anyway.
My favorite Phil Collins stuff is Easy Lover. That's my favorite song.
What? Deborah, so full of it. What? Deborah, please tell me how they thought there were no dinosaurs.
Well, it was just presented to me a couple of days ago, and I was told I was kind of foolish for believing that there were such a creature in our past.
I don't think they said you're foolish, but I just
definitely didn't say they were foolish. It was Adam and I, and we were playing with the concept of the idea that dinosaurs could have been faked. Could they have been faked? And looking at like when the discovery of fossils were, we're just looking at a few different things. And if this could have to do with peak oil and the concept of fossil fuel coming from dinosaur bones, and if that's actually like a resource from the earth that's renewable and not something that's so finite.
Yeah, actually, it's so interesting. When I started writing my book, which, by the way, I guess I have not said this up front for everyone listening, my new version in color, about 80, 90 more pages, is going to be released. I'm doing a live lecture at America's Stonehenge September 24th, and my new version of It's Not Aliens, Worse, It's Us, the new version is coming out a couple weeks prior. So it's been 9 months of revision. So the new book is coming out. And as far as conspiracies go, you know, when you're looking at like, okay, well, if there was an ancient high-tech human society, if the world was once globally connected in a different, more conscious way, what other things don't seem right? One of the things that I had to chemically, like I had to scientifically put down, but was fascinated by, is there is no explanation as to the source of oil. Like one, everyone gets upset about oil spills. For those of you listening, why don't you find out, go internet search how much oil naturally leaks into the ocean from the ocean, how much oil is leaking. And it's like thousands of oil vessels because the ocean's just seeping with oil. It's just a thing. But I would love, Deborah, would you love to see a bunch of cave guys or like really smart ass ancient smart humans with giant rubber feet just going, this is going to totally mess with Adam.
Yes.
Just stamping out feet. Some guy walking around with really big rubber shoes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm making a pterodactyl now. I got nothing else to do but punk the future.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind. You know, we talked about this last episode, and then it came up with our guest as well. And yeah. he also thought we were maybe a little crazy, maybe a little.
Oh, that's all right.
But he came at it from a different angle as well. But I don't doubt that there were giant creatures. Like, there's no doubt. But okay. I'm questioning some timelines, and I'm questioning some of the ways in which it's presented to us.
So, okay. So up until a few years ago, and by a few, I mean, maybe a decade, one of the problems and what I love about creationism is one of the theories is, hey, well, how do you date a layer of earth? Well, geologically, you date it by the kind of bones you find it. Well, how do you date the bones? Well, you date it by the layer of earth that you find in it. So it's like, hold on a minute. How is George Orwell's, how can you have two opposing views? Double think, you know, how can you double think the dating of the earth based on layers that you're dating with bones that you're dating because of the layers? So what chicken before the egg here, right?
Right.
So the dating may be up, but there's a few technologies that are really not just been on the event horizon, but are really getting news now. One is sedimentary DNA testing. So we're talking nuclear DNA testing. So we're talking grains to atoms, being able to identify not only species. They did it in the cave where they found the Denisovans. So they found 127. There's a paper that just came out a few weeks ago. Oh, well, at this point, it's been like 3-ish, 4 months, but they found more evidences as to, okay, so just 127 species, flora, fauna of what was in this cave just from a little bit of sedimentary remains. And that's a new process. There's OSL dating. So you have optical stimulus luminescence. So this has to do with the last time anything saw sunlight. Now, there are too many overlapping technologies now, and carbon 14, carbon 13, there's a million different new carbon tweaks and dating methods. Yes, there were some tweaking that needed to be done because of modern human nuclear testing. So we could geek out a little bit about ancient human Vedic literature of maybe pre-75,000 or pre-Younger Dryas testing of ancient high technology weapons. And you could say, well, that could throw off carbon dating if there were nuclear weapons. And if we have cities in India that show signs of nuclear weaponization, them having some sort of conflict.
Well, they talk about it in the Bhagavad Gita, right?
So the Bhagavad Gita has, there's a bunch of Vedic literature that kind of references what appears to be, when I say kind of, it references clearly, it sounds like nuclear weapons. And it was even Eric Von Daniken's argument about the Ark of the Covenant, you know, in Chariots of the Gods, that they're describing what appears to be radiation suits, you know, the holy suits. They may have put a bunch of stars on it or something, or wiggly lines, but they may have sewed up the radiation suits. And then when you don't handle the radiation, ancient high piece of technology, you die of radiation poisoning, or you get red skin, and you know, there's a bunch of bad things that happen and you die. And so there's definitely some indicators of high technology in ancient past times. And some of that, if it was nuclear, would affect carbon dating. But so OSL dating is different. Sedimentary nuclear DNA testing is on, not just like, it's not new, it's been around for a long time, but it's now getting news. It's getting scientific traction. And it's not about people feeling, you know, the joke about archaeology and science is that, you know, archaeology changes at the paradigm shift on our history changes at the rate of the death of one archaeologist at a time. And sadly, that can be kind of true. But when it comes to ancient things in the ground, like I was just at America's Stonehenge a few weeks ago, exploring, we were doing some of the new work for some of the new documentary work I'm doing. But then, you know, we were looking at some of the new results from the OSL dating, and there's a lot, there's 800 sites like America's Stonehenge, and all of them, you know, there are certain portions of it that have been rebuilt and utilized by subcultures over time, right? So you have people repairing, you know, something gets 20 years old, it gets repaired, or 30 years old, and it might need a new plaster coat, or it got patched up after a storm, or a tree fell on it, or they cut a tree down and it fell on it. I mean, there's a million different reasons why to modify an ancient piece of technology, or It's disgusting. It's sad, I guess. It feels bad, I guess, to think about how the Great Pyramid and some of these sites, Tiwanaku in South America, they were all being pillaged by locals to build new homes, to build new buildings. The Spanish, the church, they didn't just build on ancient ruins. They took the ancient ruins and they remodified them. The Greeks themselves said, you know, the Temple of Delphi, we didn't build this. The gods did. We built, we added on, we improved on what the gods did. Same thing. The Spanish asked the Inca, well, who did this? And the Aztecs, they're like, the gods built this. And so we have such a break in our history. And, oh, to your point about how old are things. When I was at the Galt archaeological site, the founder, this is the largest Clovis site in North America, which is more well-known outside of America than it is here. This was just a couple of weeks ago. And it actually ties in the Kincaid Cave because it has to do with the timelines of how many peoples were in America and where it was it, you know, the Chinese up and down the West Coast and into the South and Central America. And you have the, again, the Vikings, but pre-Vikings, we know Irish monks were here. We know that there are church records. I have a book from Yale even talking about the Holy See discussing maps and routes to America in the 1200s. So there is clearly a chunk of history that is selectively not being taught that we're well aware of. Then there's just what's implied and what's going on. And the Galt archaeological site, what's really important about it is that you have this Clovis layer. It has a mastodon that was killed by humans. It's called a mastodon kill site. And there are 19 in North America. And this one's probably one of the most important ones in the world because not only was it a female kind of baby, well, younger, it really is a long nerd out as to explain how hard it is to kill something that big with for humans to take down. You don't do it up close. And this female mastodon, there's even tools that they were using to carve out on the head. So that's at this site. It was a site of manufacture where they're manufacturing arrow and spearheads for the throwing.
Really? Yeah, kind of throwing crossbow kind of an idea almost.
It's crazy. They tested it. They told us at the Galt site there are world competitions for this now, and they're so good that they're saying that a fully grown adult can throw accurately, like basically in a circle, like, you know, what you could do with your hand, 1,000 feet. And wow. They tested it on a bison herd a buffalo herd that, one of them was sick. So they had a guy standing by, they had a ranger. It was an anthropological study. So they brought in one of these world experts and they had someone standing by with a rifle to make sure it would die quickly. But they had this guy do a full adult throw to take down this beast that was sick and was going to be killed anyway. Well, he hit it from five. They said not, I think it was close to 500, not feet, but like, I think it was like, yeah, I think it was more like 650 feet. I can't remember how many yards right now, but yeah, like over 350 for yards. I mean, it wasn't 1,000 feet, but it was one hell of a distance. Yeah. Not only did it drop it in one throw, when they autopsied it, they went right through the shoulder and into the heart in dead throw. One throw.
Wow, that's incredible.
And so you wonder, what would it take for a group of humans from 1,000 feet to take down something like a mastodon? You would not want to be near a mastodon if you don't like the, they just didn't think the penetration of that spear, the velocity would have that kind of effect. And it was terrifyingly devastating what it did to that beast, you know? And so for a group of humans working together to take down a full-grown mastodon, that would be some teamwork, but you could do it. You don't want to be around it while it's rushing and charging at all.
No kidding.
So they have all these interesting things at this site. We could probably talk more about it, but one of the things that's most fascinating is below Clovis, there's a dead zone. And then 20 feet deep at the Galt archaeological site, G-A-U-L-T, Galt, north of Dallas or Austin, 45 minutes. You can go there. They're open on the weekends. You can do a private tour. We did a private tour. I was there with Freeman and some friends. I set it up for us to have a private tour because we were going to go do that. And what we saw was the site where they found about 20 feet deep, a floor of a human working area that was a tiled floor. Nothing you would recognize, but it was made out of stone. And the floor now is estimated to be more than 20,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So that's at the same site where the Mastodon kill site was at, which is what's interesting also about that, to your point about anthropological timelines or biology, is that they found a Mastodon. I was told this was just 2 months ago. There's been a body found with soft tissue, and they're saying it's only 5,000 years old. So we're talking about the timelines for some of these, you know, like they found soft tissue on a triceratops that I remember the news on that a couple of years ago. That would mean that they said it was at least 33,000 years old, but that was impossible. There shouldn't have been triceratops 33,000 years ago, right? And they're saying that this soft tissue was indicating that. Also, they had found, I believe it was cartilage or another soft tissue element off a T-Rex. And so I will say to both these guys, Deborah, that there is something off about, we don't have a complete paleoanthropological record. It is an exception to become a fossil, let alone even survive the ages. So whether you're a laptop or a person, sedimentary nuclear DNA testing is a game changer, because you can, no matter what the timeline is and what you guys, or whatever the negatives or positives are on millions of years, there is a process to genetic mutations to a point. OSL dating, the sun doesn't change as far as what we know of in the last few billion years. So OSL dating is promising for keeping us on track on timing. And granted, it only goes to, we only got it down to, I think now it's on the stretch, it's a couple hundred thousand years. OSL doesn't really go back where we need it to yet. But the concept then of biological DNA backwards as it mutates or changes, but being able to now test every grain of dusted bone of every generation of everything in the ground, like Doggerland off of Europe, you know, all of Scotland and France were connected. They did nuclear sedimentary DNA testing, had an article just a few months ago. They took samples from the saltwater ocean and were able to determine from nuclear sedimentary testing what flora and fauna was growing in Doggerland. That was 9,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago. I mean, Doggerland, quite a bit of it was up post-Younger Dryas. I mean, 5,000 years ago, it was still up. 18,000 years ago, it was a damn continent. And they're pulling up saltwater contaminated granules and telling us what plants were growing. That's pretty badass. And that's
pretty crazy.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on. I think it's hard to juggle all of it in your brain. And then, you know, it's easy to go down some of these roads, isn't it? Where, like, what set you guys off on the timeline for dinosaurs?
Well, I mean, it's all of it, really. All the timeline. You know, it's like if we're having trouble piecing together something that happened 100 years ago, mm-hmm. and then we're having trouble putting something together that happened 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years ago, but yet we have a lot of people, especially people who don't really look into it, but regular folks who've watched Jurassic Park and, you know, like been a part of pop culture, who feel that they know all of this history from millions of years ago about dinosaurs. You know, it's like, I don't know. I feel like that could be equal parts propaganda as it is anything based in fact, just to put us in one direction of thinking or another. And then particularly when you look at like the peak oil scares that happen, and that idea that's put into so many people's heads that the fossil fuel comes from the fossils of the dinosaurs, such as the Sinclair dinosaur on the sign, and all of that. You know, it's like, is some of this narrative in modern time being used to control the way people see the way even pricing of oil is today?
It is very fascinating to when you know, getting back on the oil thing, it's pretty crazy looking at how is it that you guys legit don't know where oil's from? They actually don't know. Mm-hmm. They don't know. So it's really interesting that, and again, to a point, we can't figure out geopolymers. So to a point, you can know what's in a recipe. Basically, for anyone really trying to figure out why we can't figure out a recipe to anything, it's like, well, why has no one ever figured out the secret ingredients to Colonel Sanders or Coca-Cola? The fact is that people come close, but no one outside of those companies, there's no electron microscope. There's no amount of chemical testing that ultimately can deconstruct some of these existing products or smells or fragrances or what have you. So the reality is that there is a lot of mystery to something like, well, like Terra Preta, like ancient engineered soil that we started talking about.
Really good example.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's literally no recipe. They mimicked biochars, but they don't know. So here we are with oil, something we use every day. It's leaking out. And again, don't you, here's a mystery. Again, why is it not pointed out that millions of gallons leak into the ocean every day? Well, okay. I'm just exaggerating. Yes. Tens of thousands of gallons. There is oil just seeping out of the past. So what is it? You know, what is producing it? Is it just like methane? Is it just this perpetual, I don't know, earth juice?
Yeah, because I've heard, I mean, I don't know at all, but I've heard people talk about oil reserves, which are claimed to have been tapped and done, and there's nothing left, and they move on, and then they come back a number of years later, and it's brimming, it's full. And that doesn't really line up with it being a finite resource.
Deborah gets red pill, the answer is Keebler Elves for 1,000. Boom. Little oil Keebler Elves.
little underground. Well,
and to what you're saying about the ocean, you know, what was that like 10 years ago that there was the Shell oil cap that they were trying to get on that was under the ocean? They'd been drilling. They were saying, we can't do this offshore drilling because we did it. And then we stopped and it started coming out. So they were trying to put a cap over it. And it was like big mainstream news for like, you know, 7 days straight that if we don't stop this, the entire ocean's going to become contaminated.
And then they never talk about, they rarely talk about, oh, there's this bacteria that literally lives in the ocean. All it does is eat oil.
Right.
Huh. How many millions of years did it take for that to come along? And, you know, and on that note, like Tuba, that field of dinosaur footprints, it's nuts. It's huge. It's acres and acres and acres. And it might be more than a square mile. That's just where we park. And as far as you can, and I might be wrong, the distance that I'm judging to where the actual mountains start. And mind you, by mountains, they're really tall, flat top, ground down mountains that are now more like bluffs of flatlands that were 100% occupied by the Anasazi. So you have the Navajo living on land that is once Anasazi, and you have the Anasazi bones literally exposed and being trampled on by grazing cattle on those bluffs. And a complete mystery still as to how and whom built or did those, those areas have so much, again, modern. So when I say modern, I mean, anything past the biblical flood, we have a lot of stories, the ant people saving indigenous tribes out west and taking them underground, and then underground cavities that are man-made being found, and there's no explanation for it and just gets like shrugged off. So why is there a natural bacteria cleaning up the ocean from oil? It's just, and it's a product that we can synthetically rep. So what is our, when they say we take it for granted, oh yeah, there's synthetic oil now. What, you know, all we imagine is what, melting plastic water bottles to, you know, what do we think oil is then, right? If it's synthetic, what are they doing?
Yeah. And
there was never a shortage. That's what blows my mind. You know,
yeah, the whole that, peak oil.
That's the real, really that's what, the real key point to like what sent me and Adam in this direction.
Yeah, and we might be more conspiratorial minded than you, Jared, on this topic, but it seems like when you get to oil being finite and running out, and them telling us that we're going to reach peak oil in the next 10 years from the invention of combustion engines. Mm-hmm. It seems like a great way to push climate change, climate, disasters and states of emergency, and ultimately the necessity of culling large amounts of the population down to, some would say, 500 million people.
You know, that, as you know, has driven me nuts for years. One of my new documentaries is going to be about that. I wouldn't normally do this, but since we're doing this on the show, I will show you guys one thing, which I think will come through on camera for everyone. But I have to give credit where credit's due. And it was Michael Tellinger. And I was doing some just, field exploration in South Africa at his invite. And he made a great point about the amount of humans on the planet that if you have, and at the time, so this is a couple of years ago, and we're at 7.5 billion people.
I think they said in November, we're going to hit 8 billion.
Well, what great timing. Can you guys see that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You recognize America? Let me pull that back up again for you one more time. Is it going to focus? There we go. Yeah. So you can see Florida off to one side.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If you gave every human being 1 acre, that is the entire human race at 8 billion people with 1 acre each.
Right.
That's incredible. Yeah, we've heard a couple different versions of that.
That's an excellent visual. So
thanks for letting us see that one.
Well, there's your insight to part of my new documentary. There's nothing I've hated more for years, and I won't waste anyone's showtime, but I will just say this. You want to see me go off for a while privately and for funsies and me just being completely inappropriate? Let me talk to you about the arrogant, hubristic bullshit of the Georgia Guidestones. I will... So you have a manual, you got that manual. It said there should be 8 billion mosquitoes and 6,487 bison. And you don't even know, we're discovering 3,000 to 5,000 species a year. You don't even know what the hell's on this planet. You have the arrogance to put down how many humans should be on it when we have more than enough food, more than enough everything. And you just saw how many people 8 billion is. They don't even take up the damn continent we're on. And I could go further. But that's just an example for Jared's future read on there Audible. that's, you see a visual like that, right, Deborah? And that's the human race. The rest of the world is empty. Yet to your conspiratorial point, is there clandestine organizations running the world? And here's what's terrifying. I don't think they have the old machines from some ages gone where they're smarter. I think these people are also, and really this is a shout for help to you guys. You are operating at the same 12 to 20%, 15% consciousness we are. You think you're doing a better job. You're not. And that's why we still have cancer. And it's a control thing at this point, I think. The artificial pricing of things, we can go on a diatribe of how economics work with the value of ducks. That's what literally had myself walk right out of my first and last economics class. I was not going to hear about the fake value of ducks. Drove me out of my mind. But this oil thing made up. The idea we can't feed everyone or house everyone. No, we can. We obviously can. But then we have some jackass with the Georgia Guidestones putting them up going, we really have too many people and we're ruining the world. Yeah, okay. The world has an expiration date and it's when the sun blows up. So you preserve it as shiny as you want because it's going to be a sizzly little nothing in a few billion years. I don't know what people are thinking. Just remember, you don't even know how many things we literally found an otter. I can't remember the name of it. It's as big as a seal. It was spotted in Brazil in the Amazonian. It was in the river, in the Amazon River, in the middle of the Amazon jungle. And they were like, oh, we thought that was extinct. So it's not like we're just finding new crap. We're finding things that we said were dead.
Right. Or in your book, you got, there's a tree that you talk about. I think it's like a type of cedar tree that was discovered, quote in quotes, discovered. But yeah, it was like larger than any of the trees that were around it. And we spent time in that forest for a long time. And then suddenly we discover the largest of the trees that are there.
Yeah. 379 feet tall. Maybe it's 380 now, but Hyperion. And so for those of you who have not read the sci-fi novel, not related, but Hyperion is, it's four books. Don't, it's pretty incredible, but part of it, they named it, part of it was named because of the tree, to geek out a little bit. But Hyperion was photographed by National Geographic. This is a redwood. And you see trees around it and you're like, oh, well, doesn't look, I mean, it's tall, but those short trees are 100 feet plus tall.
How tall is the big one?
379 feet.
And where is it?
It's in an undisclosed forest location in America, because they don't want, so it's okay for the, yeah, it's a, no, it's not a sequoia. So it's interesting.
In Sequoia National Park, though, that's where the General Sherman tree is. I've seen that in real
life. Look up, if you have the time, I mean, if while we're chatting, you can look it up. Look up Hyperion.
Okay.
The tree.
Yeah, I'll look it up. Yeah, because I've been to the General Sherman tree, and that's supposedly, according to the people that make the rules, the largest living organism on the face of the planet.
Oh, the largest living organism on the face of the planet is Pando. Now, that's if you're not counting the new networks of fungus and bacteria that have been found.
Yes,
Pando. True. Pando has been dying, and it's an aspen that's cloned itself to the tune of, it's a forest. It's, I think, sadly, it's down to less than 60,000 trees, but it is a single living organism, and it's called Pando. And there's an article in Forbes that I had quoted in my first book about Pando. The world's largest organism is dying. And it kept cloning itself and spreading out in the earth. And it's one of the theories I connect with engineered soil like Terra Preta, that if we had tree networks, they can communicate amongst themselves. So if you look up Pando, that's the world's largest living organism. Sherman. Okay. So Sherman is a sequoia. And by the way, here's an interesting thing about sequoias. Sherman is a sequoia. There were, before sequoia, there were metasequoia. And so for those that study trees and the origins, they don't have an explanation for the origin of metasequoia, which are the granddads of sequoia. I find that very interesting. Don't know how to make Terra Preta. Don't know where sequoia from. Was it the chicken? Was it the egg?
Or were they designed?
So I just looked it up. So Hyperion, it says Hyperion is a coast redwood in California, considered the world's tallest known living tree, measuring 115.92 meters. Hyperion was discovered August 25th, 2006 by naturalist Chris Atkins and Michael Taylor. The tree was verified as standing 115.55 meters tall by Stephen Sillett.
Yeah, so
it's 380 feet.
Yeah, so Hyperion is, I love this photo of it.
Yeah, it took us a long time to discover that.
Yeah, you know what? It's a hard one. It doesn't really like stick out amongst the other shorties at 150 feet. But what I find interesting is I have a map originally in my book, and the feedback has been, of course, I'm going to write a lot more. I'm going to deconstruct the main book. There's so many points that we live in what is really a biotechnical engineered planet. I don't think this is random. It's not about intelligent design. I do think that the way you get anything that lays an egg, when it only lays eggs, it's not an evolution. I think it's a program, and it's something that you create. I mean, we have gene CRISPRs you can buy right now, and we could all be doing some super Island of Dr. Moreau crap right now in our garages. We could really put Deborah down the red pill.
Woo.
We can make you a new dog, Deborah. Do you want it to fly? Because I think it's time to try.
Fly with a trunk?
Oh, why not? I think that it could, Yeah, no, so I could go down that rabbit hole, but the whole world used to be sequoia and redwoods. The map goes from Siberia to California. And again, you got to think, okay, well, how much of this was above ground or above, like how much below water was above ground and where were these forests? But there's this original sequoia redwood map. You have a society that can move 3,000 ton blocks. Why wouldn't they be using wood and trees that were 380 feet tall everywhere? I mean, how easy would it be? And are we really looking at like rampant lost programming code? So like, are we looking at are trees really just like, you know, subroutines that have been left unprogrammed? I mean, what does a fully integrated 100% conscious human network look like on soil that has piezoelectric properties, that's connected to polygonal constructions that don't just deflect earthquakes and but manages frequencies and energies? And are they being managed through not only above ground tree placements like Pando? Think Pando. You might want to look up Pando while we're talking too. You're going to like that. That's in the book. I have a picture of it, but just look up Pando, world's living organism, and imagine that network all connected together and on a conscious, subconscious level, being able to transfer information between bacterial and viral networks, which could be, you could call them subroutines, to a tree network that wasn't just random fluffy trees as we see them. What if they were able to be programmed to like more shape out into things that were more useful? Not that we'd pluck them out of the ground and use them in a manufactured sort of way, but I think we take for granted a lot of the natural world as just being this random environment. Yet I don't think you get anything from an egg without programming it to be an egg. Mm-hmm. Not a thing. But this Kincaid cave, right? I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go back to that.
So I'll just rip the band-aid off. There's no Kincaid cave. Now, I'm only going to tell you that to a 98.9% because I'm a hopeful, half full person. So here's how this works. Rex from Leak Project and I get out there. There's a ton of footage. I have not, believe it or not, it's less than a year ago, although I'm going to hit that year here soon. So I really got to get on with the documentary on it. But for everything that we've just chatted about, we have extensive 6K footage, and it's not, it was with a really long selfie stick. It wasn't a drone of any kind, but we happen to have we have 6K, gorgeous 6K photography of exactly where the Kincaid, we went out, by the way, we went out for an afternoon and went, oh, can't find it. We went out every day for hours to locate the Kincaid cave. Could not find it. And we methodically filmed from the Quagunt River, the whole area that cave is supposed to exist based on Kincaid's. First off, no one can actually find that this G.E. Kincaid was a real person. But let's just say he was. Let's just say the two articles were real. We have the Quagunt Rapids. We have a distance from the rapids, which was within a mile. But just so we're clear, we extensively photographed and explored that side of the canyon where here's what we're left with, our 1.2% of hope. If it really was carved out Chinese or Asiatic or even Egyptian, likely it was supposed to be Asian, 80 mummies. And, you know, if it was what it was, and the Smithsonian came and took everything, they would have had to blow up the entrance and they would have had to have collapsed it. Is that a hypothetical possibility? Yes. And if they did do that, there would still be a heat signature between a cave and the outside. So the only thing that we have left option to us is someone has generously offered a $10,000, I'll just call it a night vision thermal imaging floating device that would allow us to see the temperature differential between, you know, the setting and cooling of the canyon. And if there were caves, we would then see, if there was an opening. So if it was collapsed the theory goes that perhaps, even though, now here's the thing, again, the Kincaid Cave was not like a 5x5 kind of a whole entrance. The Kincaid Cave is this very grand, over 20 feet tall, wide, very open. Oh, Deborah, I left one part out. The story goes bananas. He walks in to what is mummies laid out, described as like 80, and they're in sarcophagi of some kind. But then he says he walks down a very large tunnel to what is essentially an underground city. Now, there we, I just told you, we found, they found a 40 mile long cave system that was just one of, and again, overall Carlsbad has a ton of caves in it. So for the, you know, head researcher for Carlsbad to say, we think there's more caves in the Grand Canyon than Carlsbad, that's a lot of caves. And so for us to have only explored less than barely half of it also says something. So this guy, allegedly Kincaid, found the mummies, kept going, found allegedly a city, also said he ran into some snakes or something. I mean, just, it's just like, there's a point where you're like,
Was there a giant skeleton involved in the story at all?
I was going to ask you how you feel about giants.
I don't think there was a giant skeleton. It was really just, I read the article. I downloaded the articles, the actual Arizona Gazette articles that were like, okay, what are you describing here? And went over and over and over all the information on the Quaggunt Rapids. And no matter what, he was clear about the rapids. That was a point in the story that's not refutable. That point is at, I think it's mile marker 53 or 58. I don't know why I'm blanking on that at this moment, but you know, so every time I talk about this, I'm still like, it's a working question for myself and for everyone listening. Don't think of it as a foregone conclusion. Is it possible they collapsed the cave? Yeah, but that's a lot of effort. You know, but from what we could view, and I can tell you that we viewed it pretty graphically and pretty extensively, I see no opening. So on one hand, I would like people to be interested in the story and still, of course, you know, trust but verify. But I do think there's some open, exciting mysteries about the canyon besides, you know, open uranium mining permits, so everybody be careful. But the issues of the fact that there are all these adventurers out there risking their lives to climb erroneous mountains, yet they don't have any team to take them somewhere that could be incredibly valuable. And it would be incredible to have someone like Alex Honnold, for instance. You know, he free solos Yosemite. It's an incredible feat as a climber, you know, it was amazing to watch, but you know, hey, could you join a team and help us find all the unknown caves of, you know, could you come be a real Indiana Jones and like help a climbing team get past a hard point that no one else can get by? Can you be that climber and get through something that maybe somebody else couldn't do, but do it with the right safety gear? And you know, the expeditions just to get a crew on a motored boat to certain points in the Colorado to get them off to explore those 20, 30, you know, 20, 25, 28 miles in the middle.
Lots of space.
Right. So I feel like there's a lot of ballsy guys out there that, you know, they all want adventure. They want adrenaline. And it's like, the world is left for us to explore. There's parts of Canada and the Northwest Territory where they're saying that there's whole tribes of indigenous that were afraid of other tribes that were just heard of, never been seen, whole villages disappearing, crazy alien stuff. I mean, there's a number of things that are quite mysterious about, again, like Hyperion. How do you miss a 380-foot tree by plane? I mean, just, hey, that one's a little taller than the rest. I mean, how did no one spot it till 2006-08? And I'm, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
But also with the canyon and exploring down there, am I right? I've heard other people talk about having difficulties exploring areas because of like native tribes saying they don't want people looking in certain places. Like they'll know that there's a cave. Maybe this is where I was getting that giant skeleton thing confused. Someone was talking about trying to explore that they'd seen or heard of a giant skeleton in a certain cave, but then the the tribe that was in that area like cut them off and said, no, we're not letting you explore this
yeah, territory. We were with someone from the Navajo Nation. So we went there with people. We would not have done it without someone from the Navajo Nation.
Yeah.
And that really probably was the difference, is that the other thing is that why is anyone indigenous to any history or story going to respect you if you're not asking them what their stories are and what their history is?
100%. I mean,
yeah. And like you said, you can't screw up an oral tradition. You know, it's you can't manipulate it if it's not written down. Mm-hmm. And then the people telling the stories have changed. So suddenly they're repeating something that's been written by people that didn't live it. And, you know, living oral stories are hard to screw up. They get passed down. They're heard by everyone. It's very difficult to lose that, you know, connection to the origins when it can't be manipulated by a church or by an organization that, you know, page three is gone. Well, at first it's page three is gone. And then, you know, it only takes a few years before nobody knows that there was a page three.
Your page three never existed.
Nope.
Yeah.
No, it just got shorter. In fact, we don't even know why they skipped page three. Mm-hmm. And then you can just rewrite it. But there is definitely something about when you're doing any of this work where you have to be respectful of, you know, this is the challenge. Every culture has something, you know, they have 1,000 years, 500 years, 300 years, a few thousand years of history. I think one of the hardest things, it's so terrible, more recent histories of the Americas and indigenous tribes, but with European encounters. However, a lot of people don't understand, if you really want to understand, America was not a bunch of peaceful indigenous peoples. They were incredibly violent. There were many peaceful tribes. But if you look at the actual history of North America alone, let alone the Aztecs and the Mayans, these were incredibly violent people that were constantly, maybe with simpler weapons, but they were slaughtering and enslaving and brutalizing each other to a great and vast degree. And it's no less violent or definitely no less interesting. The reality is, watch The West by Ken Burns if you want to learn a little bit about it. Just if you don't want to read it, folks, just look into it. This was not a continent of peaceful people, and they were not rare to hurt each other. Although Joseph Campbell pointed out that there was a tribe in the Northwest that never had a word for murder. So I guess some of them lived in an isolated way where their vernacular didn't even include a word. Or
maybe they just murdered so much that they didn't have a word for it.
Yeah, we said hello. We thought that's meant hello. I mean, whoever
guys aren't that tribe's not around anymore though. They don't have a casino. They didn't get a casino.
Right. No, but there's some of the histories where it's like, okay, if you've been around a couple thousand years, you might want to claim this body as, you know, you're part of your tribe or your peoples. And it's like, well, unfortunately, the history of America goes back into the Clovis. It goes back to that floor that was found at Galt that's 20,000 years old. This history of this continent and South and Central America and beyond and into the waters, what we think of as underwater, was much of it was above water. And so our perception of who was here needs to really shift. And that, unfortunately, despite all the tragedies of the European indigenous interactions in the last 500-600 years, we need to actually look back and say, look, you folks are also not native, you know, your imports, whether it is through the Bering Land Strait, that whole bridge, or is it former Celts, Irish monks? Is it Egyptians? Is it Phoenicians? We know, and a lot of people don't realize that Phoenicians are one part of, they're Jewish. You know, it's not like Phoenicians. I grew up Catholic. I thought Phoenicians were just, I didn't know they were badass seafaring Jews. I had no idea. I thought the Phoenicians were just Phoenicians, but there's all these tribes, and you have stones in Hebrew found in burial mounds in the East Coast. I mean, Carl Lehrberger has talked about this for years. It took a Jewish rabbi turning upside down a section of essentially the Ten Commandments that was in an Indian burial site. I mean, the reality is the Phoenicians have been traveling here for the copper mines in the Great Lakes for way longer than our history of this continent is so skewed to say, yeah, well, there were just the people who had casinos here, and that's not true. And so we all have to be accepting of the fact that we are all one world global society that has a very mixed bag when it comes to handling everyone and outsiders and being friendly and unfriendly. And for us to really table all the facts, which include all these people have been here, and it just isn't, oh, you know, there was this once beautiful land of loincloth wearing deer killing peoples that all got along. That's just not the actual history of America or Central or South. But the G.E. Kincaid Cave, unfortunately, like I said, it's just its story, whether it was, you know, at first there was said it was an April Fool's thing, but it wasn't really published on April Fool's. And at the same time, it didn't really help with tourism. And the reality is that I find it just odd on a conspiracy side, guys, that nobody threw a camera over the side, however you want to put it, and ever actually just said, well, here's where the cave is supposed to be, and there's no cave. Like, no one did that. And then at the same time, why aren't there more news articles and more activity around the adventures that are possible and yet to be taken? So that I think is the biggest mystery.
It's the it makes me wonder from that conspiratorial side, like, do we get, so let's pretend for a moment that G.E. Kincaid was not real, that the whole thing's a hoax, you know, yeah, none of it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Could that have gotten thrown out to us? Especially now, you know, to keep people from wanting to explore, like, here's this case, and look, we can prove it's a hoax. It doesn't exist. So, you know, that's the same for the entire length of the canyon. That's the same for all of this. Like, don't demand that we go search for things. Look, it was a hoax.
I think that's really a good takeaway. I think that's dead on. I think there's a, you know, huge pie of humanity, and they have different motivators, right? So I think that really eliminates a huge chunk of people. Like, well, some people were interested in going, but they just wanted to prove the Kincaid Cave right or wrong. So they're like, okay, well, that was enough. But then there are other people like, well, there's probably other mysteries. And then they're like, well, if that one's off, there probably isn't. I mean, it's a barely split in hairs, but it is two sides of two groups that would eliminate a lot of investigation. And then, well, right now, what I found interesting was that as we were there, you know, for all the pre-research, you know, there's hours and hours of work that went into this prior to going, just for the preliminary, like, knowing what gear are we going to bring. Like, for those of you interested in how you plan an expedition, or like, some of our concerns were, where can we camp? What kind of access is there? How long is it going to take us to literally bolt or create a safe way down to this cave? Like, how are we going to do it safely? What is the geology of the rock itself? What is the weather like? How, you know, if we work in teams, how long are we going to have to be on the wall? How many hours a day? Like, to get down the footage, to get to where the Kincaid Cave entrance was, we figured it would take two men or three men, 8 hours a day on the wall, passing tools up and down, and it would take to set it safely. We were thinking it was going to take at best 3 days and at worst 7 days to set a safe descent. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't like we get a really long rope and tie it together and slide down it like ninjas.
Bed sheets.
I was thinking bed sheets too. Yeah.
Yeah. With the little rascals and Spanky and some Larry Moe and Curly crap. You know, that's, yeah, there's some Buster Keaton kind of Keystone Cops physical comedy that's, you know, hanging off the side like click clacks.
Throwing the hammer down to the next guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then not between the eyes.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you this, Jared. I've never been to the Grand Canyon. So I'm sure I can't, in my mind, think of how big it is. I know that it's probably bigger than what I envision. Do you entertain the idea that there was an ancient civilization with technology that we don't understand who could have mined the land to create the canyon?
I think there is a lot of ancient mining in that area. I think that we know about it in the Rocky Mountains that specifically span the Northwest through Nevada. I think there has been, well, not that I think, I know that there have been rock cut ruins interior to mountains. I know that there are all over Arizona, a lot of people, I know some great people that want to retire and frequent Arizona. It's really challenging to me the more I learn about the radiation and the mining tailings in general. To your point about the ore piles, there are so many nickel, green, coppery, you know, rusty green looking piles of what are essentially mountains of tailing piles. And these are tailing piles from silver mines, things from the 1800s. You know, we had a gold rush, but we had a silver rush, and there's plenty of other minerals. If you look at a mineralogy map of Arizona, there are just in our times, just mountains of tailing piles that literally look like mountains. And then there's dirt bike trails in them. And I'm like, what are you people thinking? They don't understand what they're walking or moving in. And so when you look at this and the Grand Canyon, it's like, okay, one of my fascinations has been to look at the geology of what's there and wonder, as a society that's building 1,000 ton blocks and moving them hundreds or thousands of miles and building with cymatic, you know, frequency technology of some ancient period, how easy would it them, you know, would they have been able to mine, you know, hundreds of thousands of tons of any kind of anything? So the questions are, what in the tailing, what of the Grand Canyon was a useful stone? Were they mining anything that ended up in cities that are underwater, like the city of the coast of Cuba that's 2,300 feet deep? I mean, I've never really thought about it till the question, but specifically, we know that Aswan Quarry in Egypt supplied stuff 1,000 miles away. What if there are rock cut evidences out of these, you know, dried mostly sandstones and limestones with it? There's a variety of layers. The canyon's made up of a lot of different, basically, flood periods. And the question, though, about what we're doing with uranium now, well, what were they doing? What did they, was there gold and a lot of other minerals that they used to create machines and technologies, yeah, and things that ended up maybe underwater and are part of buildings that are like off the coast of Cuba? Like, what if some of these underwater excavation sites end up having materials that were actually, you know, gotten from the Grand Canyon area in general? And when you have a grain that's a particular size and you're making these piles, I have a lot of video footage of a lot of tailing piles. And when you guys look at them, you're going to go, well, that's a mountain, or that's a, and they're legit 130, they're less than 140 year old tailing piles. And by tailing piles, it just looks like a giant hill. And you wouldn't know that it was a tailing pile unless there was a history for it. So in ancient times, pre-Younger Dryas, pre-13,000 years ago, what would that tailing pile consist of? And the staining, when you're at the Grand Canyon at the South Rim, which is a weird description, but it's as you're coming from the Hoover Dam and it's the side where the skywalk is, there's all this staining. By staining, you know, when you're looking at the hillsides, not even in the canyon, just looking out at the plains and then the bluffs that are, you know, above the canyon that are just miles away, there's one that looks like there's a horse head and maybe a woman with ponytail looking towards a horse. But you can see modern mining tailing piles, and depending on what they're mining, it stains the rocks red. And you look around the Grand Canyon and go, if this is really just a giant mining area, how does it look any different? And it doesn't. And so I'm not saying, for those of you zeroing in on specifics, I'm not saying every inch of the Grand Canyon was a mining pit. Jeez, you know, there's always someone who has to take it literal.
Slow down.
You know, just imagine a few different geological things, a few different periods of use, unuse, series of technological advancements where maybe they dug a bunch and then they're like, oh, figured this one out. And a lot of people don't know much about water monitors, which are basically crazy. Someone got the brilliant idea to create jet powered. We're talking 140 years ago. These water monitors were so powerful. They could literally power wash essentially off sides of cliffs to create material to then crush up, Deborah, to make mining tailing piles out of, to get their silver, to get their gold, to get whatever they wanted to get out of the rock. Well, you can see video of it, and a great show to see mining tailing, or not only old tailing piles, areas of land that have had trees grow back. And you're like, that whole thing was nothing but an open mine field with tailing piles by the tons, Gold Rush. And
I not love only, that show.
Yeah. So you'll see tailing piles, but you'll also see a lot of the other examples of what we're talking about, including water monitors, which really is just think cliff power washer. And we were doing those 140 years ago. So how hard would it be to power wash, again, a society that cuts and moves Baalbek, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 ton cymatic polygonal blocks that they can cut and move and shape and put 20, 30 sides on? How hard is it for them to power wash down a canyon, right? Because they want things, you know, it's, yeah. It's really we got archaeoacoustics and archaeoastronomy and all these different fields where they're really getting into what are possibly lost technologies. I think archaeomining needs to, you know, and here's the thing, is it that you and I are talking about like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. Meanwhile, you know, militaries and secret organizations and our governments have been well aware of the antiquity of the earth, and that very department already exists. You know, is this, mm-hmm. is essentially Area 51. It's not a matter of it being about aliens or, well, of course, high military technology. What if the whole point is that it really is the only, one of the only places on the planet where you have a departmentalized, but a collegiate, if we want to call it that, a collegiate like research institute that is looking at all the truths that they don't tell us. Mm-hmm. That's really maybe not a way that a lot of people have looked at it, but I don't think I've ever described it like that. Done a couple firsts now. I'm on a roll.
I know. Deborah, I think you should finance a field trip for us to go search for this cave.
Find this cave, yeah.
We'll send you over the edge, tie a rope around your waist.
Right. just make me down. A little
We'll hold on really, really tight.
Yeah, you know what? You might want to not go with these guys anywhere, Deborah. Why don't you call me the next time they say you're going to go camping? Just
we'll do I'll a let you know.
Check. Yes, I'll take a safety check for you. And then, just give me their address, you know. So if you know, if it's a long, long weekend and we don't know what happened, like you see what's happened in Lake Mead, right? With all the
bodies there,
yeah,
getting exposed.
What's going on?
I miss this.
Lake Mead is drying up.
Yeah, yep. that's the lake connected to Hoover Dam, right?
Yeah. Yep, that's the lake created by the Hoover Dam, and the mob started getting busy. They were dumping bodies and barrels, and a few months ago, they were like, the lake is 70 years at its lowest. And I mean, we're talking, guys, it is way down. I mean, way, way, way down. And they found barrels half rusted out with bodies in them. Then they found two more. And now, to Deborah's point, there's practically, I asked when I was in Vegas this last weekend, I said, you find any more bodies? And like, oh, we're finding them every day now.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Jeez. That's where Jimmy Hoffa is.
That's what I thought. I'm like, they're going to find a barrel and they're going to do the testing. And it's like, son of a gun, it's going to be Hoffa one of these times.
Yeah.
I always figured he ended up in concrete in a building somewhere, but.
They used to say that he was in the end zone of the Meadowlands where the Giants play.
Is that a curse or a blessing?
I don't know.
Depends on, I guess, your favorite team, right?
Yeah.
But the Lake, that whole area, Lake Powell, that whole area, I think is very suspicious when it comes to how did it evolve? How much of it, how far away? I know in my book, I address ancient mining piles, but there are so many that look, especially with water monitors, when you can literally power wash off the side of a rock mountain, you end up with what looks like what, hundreds of millions of years of erosion. Yet you don't have any way to date rock. You ultimately only have tens of thousands of years with OSL. There's no carbon dating. If it was a geopolymer and it was crushed sand turned into a concrete, i.e. geopolymer, then you could date a bioorganic that fell into the mix or something. There's that. That's what they've tried to do at Tiwanaku, because they say it was geopolymers, those H blocks, those few things that they have tested. That's
Dr. H-blocks are amazing looking.
Yeah. And Dr. Joseph David Ovitz, the father, the guy who actually created geopolymers. I mean, they've done testing, they published on it and said, yeah, we think these are geopolymers and they're so many thousands of years old, but then we come full circle. Well, it's like, is he part of the solution or is he deflecting from the truth? How old is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Then we can go down that rabbit hole. So it depends on how many rabbit holes you want to go down at this point too, since you guys didn't know about the bodies. You got to look into the bodies. Probably too recent though, right?
Yeah.
That's way too recent. No,
it's 60s, 50s, those are some oil related execs, I'm sure. I'm just saying.
That's true. That's true. And it all might be connected. In fact, I'm sure that it is all connected.
Huh? So there's the latest, but I think, one of the things about going to the GE Kincaid cave and actually, having known the location, having collaborated with Rex from Lake Project, having the desire personally to do field work, which is why I always want people to support either my channel or my book is being scalped out there for crazy numbers. Don't buy the old book. Wait for the new one. It'll be out soon enough. I'm going to be live at America's Stonehenge. I'm actually going to be there in person. I'll have tickets out available on Not Aliens. And I think that field work like this, where it's like, okay, we've been talking about something. It's like, it's the Grand Canyon. Yeah. You should work with indigenous and Navajo Nation people. And you should, like what we did in this case to get the information we got, I think we did it the right way. But I do think there is some adventures out there for people to have. And I think it's up to us to talk about them on these shows where it's like, hey, here's a map of the Grand Canyon, here's what isn't explored and here's how wide it is. And here's what it looks like. And it's like, well, let's look for caves or whatever. There's just, I do think there's a lot of things like, if not Hyperion, it's like, okay, well, what else don't we know? Or what aren't we shedding light on? And the Galt archaeological site, I think that's incredibly worth, even though it's on a floodplain and a lot of what you're seeing is underground and they've had to rebury it. You walk a site that literally every square foot, there are ruined arrowheads on the ground or carving pieces. Like you can't walk the Galt archaeological site it's been occupied by humans at least 20 something thousand years. And they even have a form of terra preta there. All the growing soil where the Galt site is from human manufacture of like animal meats and stuff like that. Everything there happened because it was occupied by a massive amount of humans. They think traveling all the way to the Ohio's. And I think as far as the Grand Canyon. And I think there was a much larger connected all the way to America's Stonehenge, because there's 800 sites that's known just in, from Canada through the East Coast into the Ohio's and down into Central America, where you have this kind of, again, confusing in that there are primitive people. there are people that are, you know, they're working with stone objects and tools. I mean, they were literally like left in the Stone Age, but I don't think they came from the Stone Age. I think they were put into the Stone Age. Mm-hmm. So there are sites like this that do connect. And I think it's a more fascinating conversation to get people in on the idea that, hey, let's take whatever resource you have, combine a couple and work together and go see if we can physically go put our own eyes on something that no one else. I mean, look, I mean, the guy who discovered Machu Picchu, he just went there. I mean, he took photos, he found it. The work to again, start unpacking it, that comes later. So I do want to throw the glove down for people to like consider or helping finance. I mean, the work I'm going to do in Peru. I think archaeologists in general, and I'm saying that anyone doing exploration requires funding, and archaeologists should be paid to fail. They can't just be told to find the one thing, you know, don't get mad. There's archaeologists that get mad. Like, you know, they're like, oh, I found another Roman thing. I'm looking for Greek, or I'm looking for Mesopotamia. You know, it's like they get mad if they find things that aren't in the genre of what they're looking for. And God forbid they find something that's an out of place, out of time artifact.
Yeah.
That's just the sad state of it. But I think that us talking about it hopefully helps change one voice out there that lives in that little square in the middle of America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people getting out in their, even in their own backyards and looking around and looking at things. And if there's any place that's nearby, that's a site of laying your eyes on these things for real is so different than looking at pictures on the internet or, you know, listening to podcasts or watching documentaries. Like, all those things are great. And I encourage people to do that too, but try and get out there. I think that's really great that you're going back to America's Stonehenge. Maybe we'll have to have you back on here to talk about that place sometime, because that's a place of massive intrigue to me.
Yeah. And again, it's connected to at least 800 other sites that are like it. And they're not colonial. There's information from the colonies, from Americans, colonists in the 1600s going, what's with all these cairns? There's cairns. We went to Connecticut. So it was Michael and I from Dark Hour Paranormal and Lynn from Rebellious Ufology. And, you know, we were co-hosting some shows here for a little bit, but we all met in Massachusetts. They're both out in that direction. And I went because Dennis and I and Michael had planned to do, we had done a short documentary about it that's out on Michael's channel. And then I had lectured there during the before time pandemic. And then we were going back out to do more filming and try to connect the work I just did and the ideas of the Galt Archaeological Site being part of more of a freeway culture of massive proportions, even, you know, going all the way up into there. And these are post-Younger Dryas, post-biblical flood peoples that are living primitively, but that doesn't explain the polygonal masonry from either thousands of years before that or pre-Younger Dryas. So again, it is important to say, well, hey, I'm only interested in advanced ancient technology, but that's not possible without exploring why are these people, in my opinion, bombed into the Stone Age. You know, so I don't think our history is disproportionately I don't think it's that divergent from the Vedic literatures of, hey, there were gods, which really were just their very primitive explanation of advanced humans. Because I think by the time the Vedic literature was going on, it was already like, we've already devolved, or we're already like tribal, or like, we're not a part of whatever that ancient, more advanced, you know, Atlantean or not. I think that group was separate. And so how do we separate these oral traditions and these, like, you know, super in awe moments of being more primitive and devolved versus looking at these cultures that, you know, again, it can't be a separate world when you have the same trees, the same engineered soils, the same weird buried positive gene expressions and genetic memories in all of us. So like somehow there's a way that it all relates, but the pieces of it do include primitive peoples, because it's not because they're separate humanities. They're part of something that got smashed sooner. Their genetic memories, their oral traditions, lucid dreaming. There's so many different ways that things can be recalled, and they might only be words or ideas or feelings or slivers of truths, but they're all related to this larger story. Think.
Like it.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop. What do you guys think?
I got a lot of stuff to look up.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, you do, Deborah.
I could listen to you for a long time, Jarrett, but I need a long time to process after I'm done too.
We should do a follow-up just for that. Like, now I've done processing. Now let's do the follow-up show.
Okay. We'd love to have you back sooner rather than later. Yeah. You guys have any final thoughts or questions?
No, I'm good. I mean, like I so much of what you say, like makes my brain pop off in so many different ways. I could say a few things, but I think I'd just be opening this up for another hour.
Yeah, you know? Me too.
Yeah. You know what? And that's, I'm traveling out to America's Stonehenge. The lecture's on the 24th, like I said, but I'm stopping at a few friends' places on the way. I should, there's just, something to be said about having these conversations and, taking them to the edge of our thought process and just having a drink over them or a coffee and like just processing off air.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so important.
Chud's coming to our place tomorrow. And I'm sure he's going to put his kids to bed and then we're going to have some fun conversations after that. So
we'll get deep. We'll go deep, homeboy.
Yeah. But Jarrett, so you've got your appearance coming up at America's Stonehenge. What else would you like to plug?
Well, TerraCore has been out a few months. Please go watch it. It's on my YouTube channel, Not Aliens. TerraCore kind of explains a little bit about the soil and the ancient advanced societies and how we could maybe explore that. So that documentary is 38 minutes. It's on Not Aliens on YouTube. There's notaliens.com, and that's where those tickets and the pre-book sales will be out for the new copy of Not Aliens. That'll be coming in a few weeks. I can't believe it. It's been, like I said, months of work, and come end of August here, that should be pre-sales, and ultimately the book will be available in a digital format. It'll be available in print, and we'll be working very quickly to get the audiobook out after that.
That's notaliens.com.
Yep. And okay. Not Aliens YouTube for the documentary TerraCore.
Cool.
I'll link a great documentary. That.
And I remember last time you were on, I was about to buy It's Not Aliens, It's Us. You told me not to. You said to wait for the new one. So
It's been so much work. And yeah. I appreciate that. We have a cool new cover. Again, it's in color now. A lot of good stuff. But again, it's just a lot of things to put in front of people to try to really get a unified theory together to really just help explain people's experiences of, everything from paranormal and genetic memory to the physical awe of these giant polygonal blocks and geopolymers. And again, chicken before the egg before, egg before the chicken, what is it all? It is related. It's just something that we have to just all put our heads on a little bit at a time.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, we really appreciate talking to you every time. I always look forward to it a lot. This one was extra fun because I love learning about stuff that's in a place that I can drive to,
And yeah. Oh man, you gotta go.
Yeah. So
you gotta go.
Yeah. I gotta get to Grand Canyon. So
just pick a rim.
Yeah. Right on. Well, like I said, thank you so much, Jarrett. Thank you, Chud and Deborah. We really, really appreciate you guys being here too, and Chud for setting this up. And let's talk sooner than later, Jarrett.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you so much.
Nice talking to you again, Deborah.
All right,
nice
guys.
To see you.
Peace out, everyone.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me. I'm not signed on to killing all those old people. Oh, those black babies? Fuck you, motherfucking New World Order. I will get your ass to lay that. It pisses me off. You sign on to playing God, you get burned. And all you dumbasses that serve the New World Order, idiots. playing God all day, deciding who lives and who dies.
Penis man.
And then I find out they're all screwing little kids and devil worshiping. Of course they are. Oh, you're the big elites. Oprah Winfrey and Ted Turner and Bill Clinton and Epstein, all in that seven-story pervert building in New York. What a bunch of freaks. And the fact that those pedophiles, and I'm calling Oprah Winfrey one, hope she burns in hell. Every damn one of you is a piece of crap. And you're going to be judged. So you just continue to enjoy hurting babies and hurting old people and hurting homeless people and turn us all into a bunch of idiots. Because you will be destroyed.
Mom, I'm transgender.